It is Monday, September 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump praises the absence of nuclear-capable missiles in North Korea's 70th anniversary parade. Swedish politics take a right turn following the rise of international populism.
Themes that now seem to be crossing borders and affecting national elections.
And neuroscience finds biological roots of political stubbornness. It's all ahead. North Korea Sunday staged a massive military parade marking the 70th anniversary of its founding. It featured marching troops and assorted conventional weaponry, but no displays of nuclear missiles in what President Donald Trump called a big and very positive statement. Among the foreign dignitaries in attendance was China's parliament chief. Joshua Pollack, a senior research associate at the Middlebury Institute for International Studies, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the presence of foreign guests was one reason why he's not surprised no nuclear missiles were evident Sunday.
I tend to see this as being of a piece with the presence of a number of foreign dignitaries at the event. If there wasn't going to be some restraint in what was displayed and said at the parade, why should they come? This is especially the case with the Chinese dignitary who was there. In the past, we've only seen them show up at these events where there's some measure of restraint, not necessarily in what is displayed, but at least in what is said. And it is interesting to note in that connection that Kim Jong-un didn't speak at all on this occasion. I don't know if that's related, but it seems to me that the lack of nuclear-capable systems on parade was part of an effort to break their international isolation, bring in these officials from China, Russia, and beyond, and generally show that they're on their best behavior. What it doesn't do is say much about their policy course for the longer term.
You mentioned China's parliament chief in attendance, Kim Jong-un, told him the North was focusing on economic development and hopes to learn from China's experience. Senior official Kim Yong-nam gave a speech in which he said the country had achieved status as a military power and would now pursue efforts to strengthen its economy.
Yes, this is consistent with what Kim Jong-un has been saying since April. And the themes of the parade floats reflected that. Although there are always parade floats with slogans and displays that have to do with heavy industry and high technology, they seem to be especially well represented this time. I think that the real message from the North Koreans is, look, we will beat the drum a little less loudly about nuclear weapons. We won't brandish them and test them and draw your attention to them. Now let's move on to other business, including dropping sanctions. I think that is the subtext when they talk about their economic ambitions to foreigners, is that they want to build up trade. And that, in turn, touches on the sanctions regime.
But they can't believe that the U.S. would drop the sanctions regime until they have tangible evidence. This is all pretty much symbolism at this point, is it not?
I wouldn't go quite that far. There have certainly been some worthwhile concessions. Not testing nuclear weapons, not testing missiles is of value. Demolishing the entrances to nuclear test tunnels and dismantling an engine test stand is perhaps less substantive, but it does have a certain symbolic weight. The North Koreans argue that now that they've taken these steps, the United States and its partners need to reciprocate.
Joshua Pollack said the current stalemate in North Korea's denuclearization is a result of the impasse over Washington's demand for comprehensive nuclear disarmament by Pyongyang prior to any sanctions relief. The North, he said, prefers an action-for-action approach that might involve some sort of limited easing of sanctions. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Forecasters say Hurricane Florence will take aim at the U.S. East Coast as a major hurricane. Attorney General Jeff Sessions welcomes 44 new U.S. immigration judges. Zimbabwe's finance minister announces its goal of repaying the World Bank. And President Trump assails a highly critical new book. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
In 2006, members of the International Astronomical Union, the IAU, voted on a set of characteristics that define what makes a planet a planet. One of those traits required a planet had to be clear in its orbit, meaning it had to provide the greatest gravitational force in its orbit. Since the gravity of Neptune influences Pluto, the Kuiper Belt object could no longer be considered a planet, so it was demoted to dwarf planet status. Investigators from the University of Central Florida recently analyzed 200 years worth of scientific literature. They say only one publication from 1802 used the clearing orbit requirement to classify planets, which was later found to be based on disproven reasoning. The Florida researchers say what defines a planet should be based on its own fundamental properties rather than variables such as the dynamics of its orbit. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the UN's new human rights chief vows to be the voice of the defenseless. Preliminary results in Sweden's parliamentary elections indicate one of Europe's most liberal nations is making a turn to the right. The anti-immigration Sweden Democrats that wants the country to leave the European Union and impose a freeze on immigration appears poised to become the third largest party in parliament. With most ballots counted, the ruling center-left Social Democrats have 28% of the vote, trailed by the moderates with 19%, and the nationalist Sweden Democrats with almost 18%. Henry Ridgewell in London describes to me the developments in Swedish politics.
The first results in have shown what's likely to be a protracted period of deadlock in Sweden. The governing Social Democrats Party, which heads a centre-left bloc, got about 40% of the vote. Their main rivals, the centre-right, got just under 40%. And then we've had this rise in support for the far-right Sweden Democrats, who went from around 13% in the last election to 18% in this one. That's the major move, really, in the latest election. All that means is that none of the blocs, none of the parties have an absolute majority, so they're going to have to enter difficult coalition talks. First of all, the two main blocs have very differing economic views, so that's going to be difficult. And then they have both ruled out even talking to the far-right Sweden Democrats. So for the moment, they seem out of the picture, despite them making a lot of noise about wanting to be involved in any government.
It seemed like the Sweden Democrats certainly improved their numbers a lot in this election. Is that because of the controversy regarding migrants coming to Sweden in the last few years?
That's certainly one of the main causes. The last election took place in 2014. That was before the big migrant surge into Europe that we witnessed the following year. And as I said, in that election, they got 13% and they've risen by 5%. Sweden took in around 140,000 refugees that year in 2015, more per capita than any other European country, more even than Germany. And with any country that takes in a big number of refugees, of course, there are issues over settling them into the country, over integration and so on. And the Sweden Democrats have seen their support rise on the back of those difficulties. Some analysts saying they're exploiting, they're playing off fears over that influx to gain vote share. But it's not just about migration as well. As we've seen in many other European countries, the Sweden Democrats, the far right, the Sweden Democrats actually have their roots in the neo-Nazi movement. Of course, they've moderated their language over the years, and they've really campaigned on a platform of nostalgia for a Sweden of the past, a Sweden of the 1970s and 1980s, where things were safer, where there were more jobs, where things were more certain. Of course, these are themes that we've seen really in the surge in support for right-wing populism across the globe, whether it's in Italy, whether it's here in Britain, in Germany with the Alternative for Germany party, or even, of course, elements in the United States with support for Donald Trump as well. So themes that now seem to be crossing borders and affecting national elections as much as the European Union and more broader themes as well.
The moderates say they will form a coalition government and have called on Prime Minister Stefan Löfven, who's a Social Democrat, to step down. Is that likely?
He's refusing to step down for the moment on the basis that his party, the Social Democrats, got the highest number of votes, and his bloc, the centre-left, marginally got the highest number of votes as well. So it's going to be a very difficult path for him to take to try to stay in power, but equally the other parties are going to struggle to claim that they have a mandate themselves to try to oust him and form their own government. Both of those main centre blocs have refused to speak to the far right, but there's speculation that, well, if these coalition talks between the centre-right and centre-left, a sort of grand coalition, don't come to fruition, if nothing comes of those talks, then perhaps the centre-right might be prepared to contact the far-right and say, you know, look, we'll govern on a minority basis. If you'll support some of our proposals, some of our agenda, then we can go forward and propose to form a government. It's a fairly complex process by which any government has to be formed, and there can't be another election under Swedish law until the end of December, basically until the end of this year. So they're deadlocked by law, really, into discussing a way forward, and it's really difficult to predict how this all might turn out.
Henry Ridgewell reporting from London. Thousands of Russians rallied against government-backed pension reform Sunday as most Kremlin-backed candidates for the powerful mayor's post in Moscow and a majority of regional governorships appeared headed to victory in elections scattered across the country. Television cameras caught Russian President Vladimir Putin voting, as well as Moscow's incumbent mayor, Sergei Sobyanin, shown casting his ballot. Opposition leaders said the election was more a reappointment, as candidates critical of Putin were kept off the ballot. Spurred on by jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny, thousands of demonstrators took to the streets, largely in protest of a proposed raise in the Russian pension age. Police in riot gear made hundreds of arrests, using tear gas to disperse the crowds. I asked reporter Charles Maines in Moscow whether it was a sizable demonstration in the Russian capital.
Well, it was a sizable demonstration if you sort of look at it nationally. I mean, in Moscow, there were about a couple thousand people out at Pushkin Square, and this is in the center of the city. There was a fairly sizable rally in St. Petersburg. We saw fairly big crowds in Novosibirsk. This is out in Siberia, also in the Ural Mountains, in Ekaterinburg, and in the Far East, Vladivostok, Khabarovsk, some of these towns. So if you look at it consecutively, then all these different cities combined show that it was a fairly large turnout, as Mr. Navalny has managed to basically build a network of supporters. Never mind that Mr. Navalny was actually in jail. He's currently serving out a 30-day term for violating these protest laws within Russia, which are rather strident.
Well, these protests followed one earlier by the communists.
That's right. So just a week ago, we had thousands of communists. You know, if Mr. Navalny's supporters tend to be students, some even teenagers, talk to a lot of people who are in high school. Basically, when you look at the Communist Party, their supporters are usually in their 60s, their 70s. So you have these two different aspects. But it goes to show you that this law really is unpopular. There's been independent polling showing that 90% of Russians are against this, which is why we've seen, even after Vladimir Putin, who's a popular figure here in Russian politics, he's, you know, obviously dominates the field and has for many, many years, but he came out in support of this law. And this pension reform, and it still hasn't helped. Still, he's seen his numbers tank by 15 points, which still leaves him above probably what many Western politicians would envy. But for him, this is certainly something to be concerned about. And it was interesting, yesterday was also this national, we had scattered elections across the country. These are regional races for the governorships, for some local legislatures. You know, and usually by and large, you know, Russia's managed democracy, they call it here. You know, there's not a lot of competition or sort of managed competition. And we did see Putin's ruling United Russia Party dominate those races, but we did see some kind of interesting developments. For example, some governors were unable to clear this 50% barrier, which means they'll have to go into a runoff race And they were all saying, essentially, that this was a result of this pension reform, which has proved deeply unpopular.
Well, meanwhile, in Moscow, the mayor there, Sergei Sobyanin, he won re-election.
That's right. And in some ways, you know, Mr. Sobyanin's election, it almost looked almost in its own way like a repeat of Mr. Putin's re-election back in March. You know, you had a field of candidates, and basically nobody knew who they were. Perhaps the more critical voices who were opposition members who might have, you know, gained some traction or certainly had, you know, attracted attention to the race, they were cleared out of the race in advance of the vote by not being able to pass these so-called municipal filters. So in other words, they couldn't gather signatures and things like that to get on the ballot. So clearly there was this effort to kind of crown Mr. Sobyanin. It's also interesting in the sense that the Moscow mayorship, it's a powerful post. I mean, he's technically a technocrat. He's there to serve at Mr. Putin's whim. But he is also tapped in Kremlin circles as perhaps a successor to Mr. Putin when and if he does step down. Now, Mr. Putin, of course, is in a term that goes to 2024. So that in theory isn't anytime soon. But certainly there is some interest in who could possibly fill his shoes. And Mr. Sobyanin has overseen this kind of renaissance of Moscow with deep Kremlin pockets funding the projects. You know, they've built stadiums, they've built new pedestrian park zones, and Muscovites, generally speaking, are quite happy. And yet there was low turnout because in a way it was considered just obvious that Mr. Sobyanin was going to win, and he did take 70% of the vote.
Charles Maines reporting from Moscow. The new United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, vows to be the voice of the voiceless and to uphold the needs and rights of the many victims of gross violations and abuse. In her first oral statement to the UN Human Rights Council since assuming her post, Bachelet presented a dismal view of the state of human rights around the world. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA at the opening of the 39th Council session in Geneva.
In her speech, Michelle Bachelet paid homage to the courage and achievements of her predecessor, High Commissioner Zayed Raad al-Hussein, and said she would build upon his good works to advance the cause of human rights. She said her own life experience as a political detainee and the daughter of political detainees, as a refugee and a physician who has nurtured child victims of torture, would define her work as a champion for human rights in the coming years. Bachelet listed the names of dozens of countries in all regions of the world where millions of people are being subjected to violations such as torture, arbitrary arrest, extrajudicial killings, political persecution, and restrictions to their freedom of speech and assembly. She called attention to the shocking findings of the independent fact-finding mission to Myanmar, which found strong evidence indicating genocide of the Rohingya people. She urged the Council to refer the matter to the General Assembly to establish a mechanism for preserving and analyzing the most serious international crimes. She expressed deep concern about the impending crisis for Syrian civilians in Idlib as military operations there intensify.
The suffering of the people of Syria has been interminable and terrible. I urge all nations to take all necessary action to urgently ensure their protection, as well as justice for the massive human rights violations that they have endured. In Egypt, I'm shocked by Saturday's death sentence for 75 people following another mass trial which failed to comply with international standards regarding due process guarantees.
As a two-time president of Chile, Bachelet flagged the worrisome deterioration of human rights in Venezuela and Nicaragua, noting the vast numbers of people fleeing because of insecurity and persecution. Turning to Africa, the High Commissioner welcomed the peace agreement signed between Eritrea and Ethiopia, which offered hope for an end to the decades-long stalemate between the two countries. In a similar vein, she said she hoped the agreement signed by the warring parties in South Sudan would be maintained and would create a peaceful and sustainable solution to the conflict. Bachelet ended her speech by acknowledging this was a time of many setbacks for human rights, but also a time of great opportunity. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Control of Congress is at stake in this November's U.S. midterm elections. In today's highly polarized political environment, Republican and Democratic partisans have staked their positions on the key issues, and debate does little to persuade them. That's a problem in a government that depends on compromise. Social scientists have shown that Americans are sorting themselves into like-minded groups. Now neuroscience may help explain why people rarely change their minds on deeply held beliefs, even when presented with the facts. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
From ancient Greece to the founding of America and beyond, every democracy rests on the principle of give and take, says University of Southern California neuroscientist Jonas Kaplan.
That conversation can change minds, and that if we discuss issues with each other, we can learn from each other and actually adjust our beliefs.
Back up, sir.
But on contentious issues such as gay marriage or gun control, conversations only rarely change beliefs. Kaplan wanted to know what's going on in our brains that makes changing our minds so hard. So his team studied people using a brain scanner.
You press the button as soon as you read each statement.
And on a screen, we showed them first a statement that we knew they believed in. And then after that, we showed them a series of five statements that challenged those beliefs.
Kaplan's team then tested whether people had changed their minds. They found differences between the brains of people who did and those who didn't in regions that deal with emotions.
What we found is that the people who activated these emotional brain regions more were less likely to change their minds.
The most stubborn people had the most activity in the amygdala, which responds to fear and threats and other strong emotions, and in the insular cortex, which inputs feelings from our bodies into decision-making.
So this right here in blue...
These systems evolved to protect us, Kaplan says.
The insular cortex supports feelings of disgust that we might encounter when we see rancid food, for example. And now we're seeing those systems kind of repurposed to help protect us against new kinds of threats, threats that are more abstract. In this case, it's information that the brain thinks might be harmful to us.
Kaplan says for many people, political beliefs are an important part of who they are and who they call their friends and allies.
And that raises the stakes for changing one's mind. So to change a particular belief about politics might involve not just changing your belief, but it might involve affecting your relationships with other people. What are people going to think of me now?
Emotions do play a role in judgment when we learn new information. But Kaplan adds they can also get in the way of making good decisions.
Just being mindful of how we feel and how those feelings are influencing how we're responding to that information might help.
In today's hyper-partisan environment, that may be harder and more important than usual. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Thanks very much, Steve. That is our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.